The topic, of course, under consideration is basically the corroboration.
Little, all right.
Okay. There we go. Try that. The issue of the relationship of archaeology to the Bible, and I've slightly retitled this. This is the prerogative sometimes that speakers take, and I want to address the question of what archaeology can do. And as we think in terms of this, certain issues that we need to propose are, what should we expect from archaeology? Important for us to evaluate this question. Can it prove inspiration? Can it demonstrate the accuracy of the narrative? Now, these are two questions that are sort of at the forefront of the seminar and the lectureship workshop that we have here. But I'm going to come at this a little bit differently, and I hope you're not disappointed in what we do here, but one of the things that's important to realize is that inspiration should imply accuracy. But accuracy of an account does not necessarily imply inspiration. You know, you can have news accounts that are accurate, but that doesn't make them inspired. But if something is inspired, I think we have legitimate reason to infer that there should be an accuracy to that account. And as we think in terms of what is unfolding here, we also have to recognize the limitations of the two databases with which we're working. The biblical account as well as the archaeological account. And the biblical account tells us, in a sense, that there is a limitation to what it provides. In Deuteronomy 29, verse 29, the Lord reveals to Moses, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." Now, I've occasionally seen the bumper sticker, and I'm sure you have as well, that the Bible is the answer. Try that on a chemistry test dealing with the composition of water. Writing Bible there is probably not adequate because the issue under consideration is the context. There are all kinds of questions that we can ask that the Bible does not answer with specificity. Why is the sky blue? Why did World War II begin? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that we have to recognize the Bible's not going to address. Now, admittedly, we can evaluate the glory of God because, you know, why the sky is blue. We can look at the beginning of World War II because of the evil of humanity. But, and the Bible sort of addresses those things in general, but not with the specificity sometimes that we want. Similarly, John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, John is near the end of his gospel, and he says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book." Now, I'm sorry I don't remember specifically which speaker, because I've heard a bunch of speakers in the course of this lectureship, but one of the speakers talked about this. I think it was Brother Miller, talked about the desire of individuals to want to fill in the gaps of the infancy and childhood of Jesus. Okay. That is a curious issue on our part, but the Bible doesn't reveal that information. And we have to respect the silence of the scriptures in regards to that. Then there are those other passages that will talk about something that is there to this day. Now, remember when I was a youngster and I would read these passages, particularly out of the Old Testament, and I would like, I want to go over there and dig it up because it's there to this day. And it's inevitably one of those things that the problem that exists is me. It's not the Bible. There to this day has to do with when the text was written down. It doesn't mean in 2023 necessarily. And so for one to go over there and think because the Bible says it's there to this day that it's there necessarily still there is over-reading the text. And so we have to be careful about that. Then there are those things that are written in the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel or Judah and so forth and so on. The ancient world had its sort of national archives, sort of a congressional record that was an accumulative record that took place. And for the children of Israel, sadly, those data have been lost at least to this point. Who knows what's going to be found in the future? That's one of the really nifty things about archaeology. Now, the limitation of the archaeological database. I really don't know a lot about the church building that is here, but I have a hunch that if suddenly we just, everybody got up and walked out and nobody came back here to worship, left all the furniture in place over fairly quick period of time, there's a lot of stuff that would begin to happen to the building. One of the things that little boys love to do is break glass. I may be confessing more than I should. But you can pretty well bet that the windows would all be busted out fairly quickly, the tables would be gone, and over a long period of time, the building itself would deteriorate and begin to crumble. A lot of that would be contingent upon the framing aspect of the building, but given enough time, even the steel aspect would tend to rust away and deteriorate, especially in a salty environment such as the winds of Florida. Well, this is the kind of thing that we deal with in archaeology. We have to recognize that archaeology is a human enterprise, and we need to approach it with humility. One of the frustrations that I have as an archaeologist dealing with my colleagues is the arrogance that many of them affirm, we have not found this, therefore the Bible is wrong. And I'm putting it sort of in the context of biblical studies. Or we have found this, and therefore we can know for certain that sort of all humanity did a certain kind of thing. That doesn't necessarily follow either, because people are different and how they respond and react to different things. We also have to recognize the fractions of the fractions of the fractions of the fractions of what has been preserved. Now this comes back sort of the dynamic of the building here. What has survived? If we think in terms of our own everyday kind of things, think in terms of the material that you have. Cotton, rayon, you know, nylon and all this kind of stuff. Paper, a host of things that over a period of time would rot away. Varying depending upon the humidity and temperature issues, the vermin that might be around, the people that might be around and all of that kind of stuff. But then when it comes to archaeology, then there's the issue of how many things have been identified in the process of investigation. William F. Albright, who was one of the great archaeologists, a biblical archaeologist, and one of the things that he was trying to push against was the skepticism and cynicism that scholarship had brought into the discipline. He, in the 19-teens, was worried about, I want to get to Israel and excavate before all the sites are gone. Well, he was not aware of the fact that there were hundreds and thousands of sites that had never been surveyed, and there are still hundreds and thousands of sites that we have not identified. And so, again, we're looking at the fracture, the fraction of the fraction. Then there are the fraction of the sites that haven't actually been excavated. I don't know what the percentage here is, but it's a small percentage relative to those that we're aware that already exist but that have never been investigated. Then there's the fraction of the stuff that's been excavated that's actually been examined. Now, I can tell you this from a fact. We gather at excavations thousands and thousands, literally, of pieces of pottery. And we save a lot of that, not all of it. I've probably handled and looked at, in the course of my excavation, probably over 1 million pieces of pottery. And overwhelming number of those have never been closely scrutinized. And so this is the issue. A lot of the stuff then is taken and put on the shelf. Somewhere down the line, we're going to look at this, and then eventually, sadly, the excavators themselves pass away, and then it stays on the shelf, so nobody ever looks at it. Now, the British Museum is notorious for this kind of thing. Layard, in his excavation at Nineveh, discovers all kinds of stuff and tablets and so forth that were squirreled away into the archives and storage facilities of the British Museum. And I remember just about 10 years ago, somebody was rummaging around through all of this, found a tablet on which there was an inscription that referred to a person who's named in the Bible that nobody had looked at before. Well, this is the kind of fraction of a fraction of a fraction issue that we're talking about. Then there's the fraction of the material that's published. And by published here, I mean it's been analyzed and then printed and put out there for people to see. Now, Tel Bet Shemesh, a site with which I am associated and I'm now responsible for a lot of the publishing of it, we have not issued a publication record since this excavation year of 2001. And so all of this is sort of waiting to hit the scene of the academic world. Now, part of the responsibility is mine, mainly because one of the excavators has passed away and the responsibility has fallen on my shoulders. But this is the kind of limitation of the database that we have to deal with when we're talking about archaeology. So you cannot go to archaeology and necessarily assume that you're going to find something that proves an element or a story in the Bible. At the same time, the Bible does not answer all the questions that we want to pose. It does answer all the questions that are critical for eternal life. God has granted us all things that pertain to life and godliness. But we're curious human beings, and we want to know a lot of other things, and a lot of people are not satisfied with the thoroughness of what God has revealed for the purposes for which He's revealed it. Now, when we think in terms of the Old Testament, this is the scroll of Isaiah, and the New Testament documents, these are history. Not only the items themselves are history, but they talk about history. God has operated in the framework of human activity. And it's interesting that all of the other, with the exception of Judaism, all of the other major religions in the world do not root their ideas in history. Muhammad lived in history, but his teachings aren't rooted in the activities that he did. Hinduism, Buddhism, and all of those others are basically irrelevant to what's going on in the world around us. But in the Bible, God has operated in history, in the activity of human beings. And this is the framework within which archaeology can be of some value. I want us to look at several things that archaeology can do. And we're going to look at these rather quickly. Hopefully, I'll be able to get through these. One of them is the confirmation or the apologetic aspect. A confirmation of what is going on in the biblical text. Now, many times what we're going to look at here has multiple implications, but I'm going to sort of give you examples of each of these kinds of things as we go through this. Now, that said, I am reluctant to argue that archaeology proves the Bible. That's not my goal, going to excavate in Israel. Now, having said that, I'm not denying that it does confirm the biblical text. Okay? My goal to excavate is to understand better what's going on in the Bible in order for me to appreciate the nuances of what the Lord wants me to know and how the Lord wants me to live. So I have a larger agenda, in a sense, than proving the Bible. All right? So, and this will become a little clearer as we go through this. A second aspect is the anthropological perspective that archaeology provides. How people live. Now, a lot of the things that are narrated in the Bible are peculiar, odd practices with which we're not familiar. Now, most of you are generally familiar with the kinds of things I'm going to talk about only because you've gone to Sunday school and heard people talk about them, but from the standpoint of the typical person out there in the world, this would seem extremely bizarre to them in trying to understand what's happening. It's one reason why there's a disconnect between what the Bible has and people's interest in it. Another category is lexicography. This has to do with some linguistic studies and clarifications. Then there's the illustrative aspect, where this is an illustration of the kind of thing the Bible's talking about, and you can see the anthropological and the illustrative as being somewhat of an overlap. And the last one is sort of the exegetical, the dynamic of what does God really want us to know and understand. Archaeology can enhance the dynamic of the instruction. So what I want to do now is to go through several examples of these. I'm by no means exhaustive, okay? But dealing first with the confirmation or the apologetic realm. This is the idea that archaeology has confirmed the legitimacy and accuracy of the text. Now, the Bible will talk about, after the death of Solomon and the split of the kingdom with Rehoboam in the north and Jeroboam in the north and Rehoboam in the south, it'll talk about a king of Egypt known as Shishak, who is not a very notable pharaoh, but nonetheless, he has a significant impact upon the people of Israel and Judah. In the fifth year of Rehoboam's reign, he comes up and Rehoboam pays him off with a lot of the goods from Jerusalem and the temple. And as we go to archaeology in 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 25 through 27, it will talk briefly about Shishak's foray into the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan, Israel and Judah. Well, here I am. This is from an excavation at Megiddo. And the reason I'm here is I want to show you how big this thing is, okay? This is a fragment of the top curve of about a 12-foot tall stela, and it's about this thick. And the curve here has an inscription from Megiddo that talks about Shishak being there. And so we have a confirmation of Shishak being in the vicinity, and one of the things that this helps us with is the stratum, the level at which the archaeological artifact is found, we can identify as 925 BC. And so we look at all of the material associated with this, and if we find similar material at other sites, we can infer the likelihood is that the level at another site that has the same kind of junk, that's an affectionate term, it's also, to me, a technical term. That's the same kind of junk that we have over here at Megiddo at 925, then we can date that level to the same period. The ancient world had its fashion just like our modern world does. And particularly, we'll focus on ceramics that change through time. But this is a confirmation of Shishak coming through, which confirms exactly what the Bible's talking about. And we also have record down in Egypt where Shishak preserves on a pylon at the Temple of Karnak the record of him going to various sites associated with the land of Palestine. There's a big section of this that is abraded where there is the images are all gone away. And interestingly, Jerusalem is not mentioned, and the skeptic comes along and says, Shishak didn't go there because there's no record of it on the pylon at Karnak. Wait a minute, look at the thing. It's obviously apparent that there are sections that here are worn away for whatever reason, and to argue that Shishak never went to Jerusalem is an overstatement. But we do have certainly record of him going to Megiddo. Bible will also talk about one of the really, really powerful kings of Assyria coming in and threatening the integrity of the people of Judah. His name is Sennacherib, narrated in 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19. And as he comes in, he goes to the site of Lachish, where he is laying siege to the city of Lachish. While he's there, he sends representatives to Jerusalem to try to intimidate Hezekiah into submission. Hezekiah refuses to submit, and the Lord is going to reward Hezekiah with security of the city of Jerusalem. But the Bible will talk about Sennacherib and the Assyrians capturing all of the fortified cities of Judah, among which, by the way, is the site of Bet-Shemesh, where I excavate. And we have very clear, distinct evidence of that destruction level of Sennacherib. But this is a portrayal from the palace of Sennacherib at Nineveh, where he is commemorating, I mean, he apparently impressed himself with the conquest of the city of Lachish, because in his palace, he commemorates this, and this is in the throne room. Now, throne room is slightly smaller than the room we have here. There would be a hallway that goes out that direction, and you'd come in and you'd make a right-hand turn, and the king would be sitting on his throne here, and behind him and all around the walls is a portrayal of the besieging of the city of Lachish. Now, the reason we know that is because the inscription up there reads, Sennacherib, king of the world, king of Assyria, sitting on his throne while the spoil from the city of Lachish passed before him. And the Bible narrates that he captures the city of Lachish, he moves from there to another site nearby that he begins to besiege, and that, by the way, is currently under excavation by another excavation project. So the dovetailing of what Sennacherib does and the biblical narrative comes together absolutely phenomenally. Multiple avenues of evidence that all converge to elaborate what is happening here. I toyed with talking about this one tonight, but I decided to go a different route. But anyway, maybe another occasion. Another excavation in the city of Jerusalem. And this is where it really gets fascinating. We're looking at two what are known as bullae. These are little pieces of clay that would be put on, they would have their papyrus letters or perhaps parchment, more likely papyrus. They would roll them up, tie a string around it, put a little lump of clay on it, and impress in that clay the names of the individual as ownership. And this is to sort of seal the letter, if you will. These are about the size of a dime, to think in terms of the size. But they have the names of individuals. And the names that are referred to are Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, on the upper one, and Uchal, the son of Shelemiah, both of whom, with those patronages, are referred to in Jeremiah chapter 38, verse 1. And for the archaeologists to come along and find little artifacts like this that have the specific names of relatively obscure individuals inscribed on them is just wow. I mean, if you are the archaeologist and find this, it is, you are over the moon. I did not find these. I've had other over the moon experiences, but this was not among them. But I can certainly identify with the exhilaration that characterizes this, because this is Bible sitting in your hands. And these are not notable individuals. Matter of fact, they're enemies of Jeremiah. And for us then to find the names of the individuals is absolutely remarkable. In the New Testament, the chronology of the New Testament has been tightened up significantly with the discovery of this inscription that is in Delphi. And it refers to Gallio. And his name is preserved there. If your Greek is right on top of stuff, you can recognize this. And it talks about the time that Gallio is ruling over the area, and there's a 2-year span. And so we're able to tighten up the chronology of Paul's life, and hence the larger context of the New Testament, to a large extent because of this inscription talking about Gallio. And this is a remarkable, I mean, we knew Gallio existed from other sources, but this is something that really tightens it up and gives us some further tools with which to understand and appreciate the accuracy of the Bible. Now, coming back to Sennacherib, I probably should have had this in a different order. When Hezekiah is fearing the presence of the Assyrians, one of the things that he does is secure the water supply. And this is referred to in 2 Kings 20 as well as Chronicles. And you have a passing remark in Isaiah 22. But you can go to Jerusalem today and go through the tunnel that Hezekiah had dug to bring the water from outside of the city walls to a secured location inside the city, to the Pool of Siloam, by the way, that John refers to in the Gospel of John. And you can walk through the tunnel. Now, I like that picture. I'm not very tall. I don't have to duck in many places. But there's part of the tunnel I have to duck in. That's why I like this picture. It makes me feel tall. Okay. Most of the time, I'm standing upright and erect. But anyway, I like this. Anyway, but you can walk through this. There are no lights in it. You'd better take a flashlight. And if you're claustrophobic, don't go through it. And it's about this wide and a little bit taller most of the distance and dark as it can be unless you have a light with you. And it's the length of 6 football fields. And they dig from opposite ends toward one another in order to intersect. And they did. And the water began to flow. The drop over that distance of 6 football fields is 18 inches from the water source to the pool, which is an absolutely remarkable engineering feat. But one of the interesting things is that Isaiah will talk about and lambast, the Lord through Isaiah will lambast the children of Israel because of their overconfidence. It's not the people of Judah. It's not a lambast to Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the leader. But apparently the people got sort of an overinflated view of themselves. And Isaiah, or God through Isaiah, lambast them for breaking down the houses in order to build the fortifications. Graphically, these are the foundations of the houses that have been dismantled, with which then they build the larger structure. Originally, this would have been much, much, much taller. This is sort of the footing of the wall, but it's 25 feet thick. Referred to in the book of Nehemiah, by the way, as the broad wall. I think that fits. The Hebrew language tends to name things what they are. If they had a pet dog, they might name it dog, you know, that kind of thing. And so the broad wall is called the broad wall because it's a broad wall. Okay, so this is sort of the dynamic of how all of this works. But again, archaeology has come along and corroborated what the text actually narrates. Now, admittedly, there are a few skeptics that will come along and say, we don't know for sure that's for Hezekiah's tunnel. That's Hebrew for you don't know what you're talking about. All right. Now, another example are some anthropological insights. This is a remarkable tomb. This is one that was found by accident. It's humiliating how many really great finds are found by accident. But they were widening the road, and they ran into this tomb. And this came to light, I don't know exactly when, but it hadn't been too long ago. But you can obviously see the opening into the side of the hill, the rolling stone that would be rolled up and close this. Now, these burial insights are typically different than what we're accustomed to. Now, we're aware of, the mausoleums that, people are buried in and so forth. This is not exactly that. These are, and of course, the New Testament will talk about Jesus is buried in a tomb similar to this, okay? And we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we proceed through this discussion. Now, if you go inside here, which this is, by the way, near Megiddo, if you go inside here, these are the openings that are there. That's the door that you're looking at there from the inside. But these little openings are here. And what would happen in the first century world, BC AD, is when a person would die, associated with a family of wealth, this would be certainly a wealthy family kind of thing. And of course, the implication in the text is that Joseph of Arimathea is in this category. And so when a member of the wealthy family dies, it is a group burial. All right, so numerous individuals are going to be put into this over a period of time. And so the individual would be taken in, they would be laid out and wrapped in linens with spices and so forth. And then over a period of time, the body would decay. They would gather the bones up of the deceased, putting the hip bones in another location and some of the other bones in another location. But the long bones in the skull would be put in a box similar to that, which is known as an ossuary. Ossuaries are typically about this long, about yay high, and about yay wide, made out of limestone. This one is highly decorated and certainly implies someone of wealth in addition to have, this is not from this tomb, but this would be from another tomb that was found by accident, by the way. And on the end of this, there is an inscription. It says, Joseph, the son of Caiaphas. And to my knowledge, not only believers, but also people who are not believers at all will concede this is probably the Caiaphas of the gospel accounts. Which is sort of, wow. Now, admittedly, Caiaphas, the high priest, would be somebody who would be wealthy. He would have a decorated, it's understandable that he would have a decorated ossuary such as this. By the way, this again is not the tomb in which this was found. This was found in another tomb discovered by accident. But the anthropological insights that come into play. When I was a youngster again, my dad was a preacher. And I, first Sunday after I was born, I was in church services. I remember it well. Just like I remember Bill Glade. But I've been in church context literally all my life. They tell me I wanted to start preaching when I was like 6 years old. And I'm not going to deny that. And I went into full-time preaching for 25 years and then have preached for 20 years even after I've started teaching at Harding. But, church has been my life. But I remember as a little kid, there was a mysterious passage that just bewildered me. How is it this Legion dude lived among the tombs? Because my image of a cemetery was the headstone, and that was it. Now, we've sort of gotten away from the standing headstones to the one that is level so the lawnmowers can go over them and all this kind of stuff. But I remember in Cleveland, Tennessee, when we lived there, there was this sort of above-ground structure that someone had built for the family tomb and so forth. I was always enamored with that. But I never connected with that being the kind of thing. And in a sense, that isn't the kind of thing. Legion is living among tombs like this, where someone has gone in there and they've sort of desecrated the tomb and he's living inside this structure. Now, he's possessed with demons, okay? Issues are not something that weighs heavily on his mind. And this is the kind of context within which Legion is living. And this helps us better to understand what's going on here, and as far as the setting is concerned. Not that it's a critical issue from the standpoint of, you know, my faith is going to crumble or be built as a result of this, but it's a clarifying issue, all right? But there's another one that is sort of mysterious, and a lot of people still wrestle with this one. Remember one time when Jesus is talking to people, you know, someone comes up and says, I'll follow you wherever I go or wherever you go. And another, Jesus says, come follow me. And the guy says, let me first go bury my father. And Jesus crassly says, leave the dead to bury their own dead. Now, most of us react to this, boy, how cold-hearted is he? Several issues. One, in the ancient world, when a person passed away, they were buried the same day they died. So the likelihood of this individual being there with Jesus when his father had died is pretty slim in the first place. But secondly, it comes back to the burial procedures. Remember, I described this. When the person dies initially in these wealthy families, they're taken into the interior of this kind of structure. They're wrapped up and laid there and left a year. That's their first burial. Then there is another burial procedure when the bones are gathered up and put in the ossuary, and then the ossuary is then moved back into one of those radiating chambers. Almost certainly, I'm not going to say absolutely certainly, but almost certainly that's the issue about which Jesus is speaking. His father's already passed away. Now, obviously Jesus is concerned about human emotions of some kind, because when Lazarus died, at least some will say Jesus shouldn't have waited, and you get sort of that impression from the sisters when Jesus finally arrives. But Jesus had another issue under consideration, another agenda, for lack of a better term, for what's going to unfold here. But Jesus wept. Now, all kinds of discussion is why he wept, okay, and I don't, but on a certain level, basically, his friends passed away. Now, those of us who are parents can feel the pain when we take our children in and they're crying because they're going to get a shot. And we're 99.99999% they're not going to die, even though they think they're going to die, but we can feel that pain. Well, Jesus is a human being too. So when Jesus weeps, I think we have to understand he is sympathetic with this. So as we look at this kind of statement, it is not that cold, calculated disinterest issue. But Jesus is emphasizing, as one may infer easily from the narrative, Jesus is emphasizing one must have one's priorities straight. A secondary burial is of relatively minor importance. I hope this helps clarify an aspect. Then you have the statement in a tomb in which no one has ever been laid before. This, of course, refers to Joseph's tomb into which Jesus is placed. Now, this, again, is critically important because if it is a tomb designed for multiple occupants, for lack of a better term, but in this case, it's a tomb where no one's ever been put before, and Jesus is put there and he's the only one, then when they come to that tomb again, he's gone. They can't accuse the women of saying, well, maybe you went to the wrong tomb, or maybe you're confusing his body with other bodies that are in the tomb thing. No one had been in the tomb before. Jesus was the only occupant, and he's gone. And this becomes a very, very significant element in the drama of the resurrection of our Lord, and one that should not be easily cast aside. Now, from lexicography and literature, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. The literature that was contemporary with biblical Hebrew was not something that we had readily available until the middle of the 19th century. And even then, there was a growing element. The Mesopotamian issues of Akkadian functionally did not come into reasonable use until 1837 or so. And this is the Behistun stone that has a trilingual kind of structure similar to the Rosetta Stone that allowed them to decipher the hieroglyphics. More people are familiar with Jean-Paul Champollion's discovery and breaking of the code of the Rosetta Stone, hieroglyphics at the top, Coptic in the middle, and Greek at the bottom. And this sort of serves as the key with which he was able to break through this. But none of this was available before essentially the middle of the 19th century. And then you had to have the scholars come through and do the translating. And again, similar to what I mentioned a moment ago, there are still hundreds and hundreds of tablets and documents squirreled away in museum storage facilities that have never been looked at before since they were discovered. One only wonders what other kinds of information might come to light. So if you want to really make a name for yourself, learn Akkadian and hieroglyphics and go to these museums and get a job. All right. The Canaanite world, again, we talked about this yesterday. This is a picture of some of the cuneiform tablets associated with the Ugaritic and Canaanite literature talking about Baal and Asherah and Anat and so forth and so on. And all of this gave us some insight into what the Canaanite mythologies and belief religious systems were like. Now, before the discovery of this, a lot of the scholars were arguing that the Bible sort of hyperbolized Canaanite religion in order to make it look bad. Well, with the discovery of this, one can readily come to the realization the Bible didn't hyperbolize it to make it look bad. As a matter of fact, it doesn't describe it as bad as it really was. So it's, you know, sort of, at best, it's neutral. But at minimum, at least, it you know, just sort of glosses over a lot of it because the people in the ancient world would be familiar with it. As far as the New Testament is concerned, for a long, long time, people thought that the New Testament Greek was a special Holy Spirit type of language. Now, this has nothing to do with the idea of inspiration. But it was a Holy Spirit kind of language because it didn't conform to classical Greek or Attic Greek. Now, sometimes you'll hear it described as being everyday language. Well, be careful how you understand that. It's not gutter language, okay? It still is a dignified kind of expression, but it became the language of everyday commerce and international diplomacy. And with Adolf Deismann's translation and production of The Light from the Ancient East, he demonstrated without any question that Koine Greek of the New Testament was the Greek of everyday people in their everyday lives. Not surprising, though, then that God would use that language as the means through which then to produce His New Testament for all humanity. And certainly those in the first century world, the classical world, who would be able to see it. How much time do I have left? Where am I? Oh, great. Illustrative use. Most of you are familiar with the story in the episode in Genesis 38 where Judah, his wife has died, and his first two sons have died, and the first son married Tamar. Tamar, as most of you would call her, but Tamar. And his third son is supposed to be given to her in order to perform levirate marriage rites. Well, the third son, he basically tells Tamar, says, wait till my son's grown up, and then, you know, you can get married and, you know, have children in the name of the firstborn. Well, she recognizes that he's now grown up and Judah is not doing what he needs to do. Well, Judah, and this is not an endorsement of what Judah does, okay, but Judah, whose wife has passed away, he is on a trip, and Tamar has placed herself strategically along the route dressed as a prostitute. And Judah contracts with her for her services. I'm phrasing this delicately, okay. He doesn't have anything with which to pay her, and so she says, give me your cord and your seal as security. And then when you send the sheep or goat or whatever the payment's going to be, then I'll exchange it. Now, when he then goes away, she takes the seal and the cord and the staff for herself. And then later it is told to Judah, by the way, your daughter-in-law is pregnant. And he says, let her be burned for her adultery. And she, oh, this is slick, she says, remember the staff and the cord and the seal? And then he immediately, with egg all over his face, recognizes, and the way he phrases it, she was more righteous than I. He never had relations with her again. Okay. What he did was not right. But nonetheless, this is the seal. This is the kind of seal that would be under consideration. These would be basically the same as the person's signature. This is an imprint of what that seal is. I'm not suggesting this is that seal. This would be the cord associated with it, because this would become part of the garment. I don't have a picture of a staff. But she has taken temporary custody of all of this in order to, anticipating how this is going to unfold, in order to demonstrate, you know, I have taken into my own hands to address this situation. And this is the kind of thing that's under consideration. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Most of the towns in the biblical world, New Testament world, are up on top of hills. This is the hill of Megiddo. And obviously when you're walking along, you can readily see the sights. And I've got to get to this next one. Okay. This was for a long time, was the only piece of recognized, and by recognized I mean that we understood really to be a part of a crucifixion. It was discovered in about 1972 or 3 in a tomb in an ossuary, back of the stone box, in an ossuary north of Jerusalem. And as you look at it, you have a nail going through a part of the bone. This is a heel bone. And the nail goes through and it hit a hard part in the post and bent the end of the nail. For whatever reason, they didn't remove it. For a long time, this was the only evidence of a crucifixion that had ever been found. Interestingly, in the land of Israel. It is from the first century AD. We even know the name of the individual. John, basically, is his name. And the location here is indicated. And this is the apparent way that the individual was attached to the cross. This is a central post, and the foot would be put on each side, straddling the post, and the nails put in, and then eventually the individual removed and put in burial. Since then, three other examples of crucifixion have been found, which is really remarkable. One of them was found in Italy from the Roman period. This is the same bone with the hole, this is the heel bone, with the hole through the heel bone, and this is the flip side of it. They turned it over and took another picture of it. And then there was an example from Britain, and this one was advertised and announced in the news not over about 2 years, 3 years ago. And it still had the nail in it. This is the heel bone. Then there's another example from Egypt that I don't have documentation, but only a verbal report about. And what's interesting is that all of these examples, and these are the only examples that we know of that reflect a crucifixion procedure. Now that's not to say that there are others, and others may be yet found, okay. But all of the evidence at this point, of which there are only four, out of the thousands and thousands of crucifixions that the Romans performed, Josephus indicates that, as well as other sources, but only four examples, but all of them show the same means of being attached to the post. I raise the question, is there a prophecy here? Back in the garden, when God is talking to Adam, and then to Eve, and then to the serpent. And he says to the serpent, he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Is this an anatomical prophecy? Or is it a coincidence? I don't know the certain answer of that. I'm inclined to think it's anatomical prophecy. Now, we don't know for sure how Jesus was attached. I mean, we know the nails in the feet and so forth and so on. But as far as the specifics of the attachment are concerned, by the way, the crossing of the feet at the bottom and so forth, it's always portrayed on the artwork, does not come into play until like the 4th and 5th century AD. So that's significantly removed in tradition from the time of the event. So, How much time we got left? Are we done? Zero. All right. I guess I'll have to stop. Even though I'm not done, I will stop.